My name's Tom Lovern, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, I guess I ought to have said Tom L., but I've been walking around 4 days with it written on the front of me. You can read across this room. I also think for Chuck and my sake, we ought to remind you that I know doctors that lost patients permanently. And we didn't lose this one. The treatment took a little longer. A great many of you also know that I am a member of the clergy of the Methodist Church. And I want to assure you that I am a part of the ministry because of AA. And I am a member of this blessed fellowship because I belong here and need to be here. I certainly want to express my appreciation to Ma and to all of the lovely people here who have made possible this wonderful 3 or 4 days for Gay, my wife, who is my lend-lease from heaven, and myself. I feel some resentments, and I feel like I ought to get rid of them before we talk about a spiritual program. And if you give me a couple of minutes, I'll do a quick inventory, and we'll try to get rid of them. One of the resentments you have nothing to do with, I've been a part of the ministry for almost 22 years. And I don't ever recall having a congregation this big. And habit alone makes me want to preach and take up an offering. We were fortunate enough to be invited here on Thursday, and we had a marvelous little dinner party Thursday evening, and at which time we who were new to this marvelous thing you do here at Palm Springs were acquainted with some of your traditions that have grown in these 11 years. I was just flabbergasted with the beauty of the hostess. I've been to so many AA affairs over the last 22 or more years, and I never have seen anything quite like this. And as we sat there Thursday evening, the hostess, Gail, said for the hostess, said, "Now, you know, our job is to look for people who seem lonely and don't know people, and we're going to do something to make them happy." And I just got my conference started off great on Friday morning until Gay caught me standing around in the halls looking lonely all the time. And and you get yourself invited to a thing like this, and they didn't tell me Luann was going to precede me on this program. I've been through this at Miami last July, and she destroyed me there. But they walk around all weekend with the arm about your shoulder, and they pat you on the back, and then they bring in these blockbusters from everywhere, you know, and you sit for 3 days and listen to them make your speech. And then when it's all said and everybody's had about all they can handle, they come around and say, "Well, Tom, you can talk this morning." And I kind of resent this, but I think it'll be all right. I think you're going to make it all right. And I'll tell you something else I resented a little bit. Ever since I got here, they've made a big thing about the fact they've never had a Protestant clergyman here before for 11 years, just Catholics. If I could just remember what you teach me about patience with my resentments, I wouldn't have had to care this one until last night. This was solved last night for me. I want you to know you brought your first Protestant drunk here, and your attendance increased by 600. Now, I quickly want to share one thought with you about this car. This is the first time in 22 years I've worn a sport coat on Sunday morning. It feels good. And all fairness to my friends and how I love them, Father Fred and so many others. I said to Gay last night as we were talking about this program, as we do so often as our day finishes, I have been privileged to sit on ecumenical councils at colleges of concern for the need to bring people of various religious leanings together for a good many years. And I said to Gay last night, you know, how strange and how simply beautiful. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous brought Jew, Catholic, and Protestant to a common ground of prayer 35 years ago, so what's new? Now, this is a spiritual meeting, and I don't know how to make it that except to tell you what God revealed through you has done in my life and is doing this day. I felt a sense of loss for how we ought to get into this. It's a little bit like an experience of some years ago in our home in a parsonage where we have lived all these years. You have certain things you just have to do. It's hard on children because it's hard to make them understand this is not really your home. We have been loaned this. And especially on Sunday morning, we were at this time, about which I'd share with you for a moment, serving a church in one of the 8 original shires of America in Charles City County, Virginia, down in the James River Basin. And our parsonage was located next door to the church. And on Sunday morning, we went through some rather hectic times, Gay trying to get 4 little boys ready and the preacher over at the church before the first parishioners arrived. It doesn't do for you to be second. And this morning was not unlike others. We were busily engaged in what everybody had to do. And since there are no girls in our household, our 4 sons were taught to do some household things. And on this morning, they were doing the things they were supposed to do. The twin boys, well, our oldest son, of course, had reached the age where he accepted as graciously as a teenager can his responsibility. Our little twin boys, about 7 or 8 or 9 years old, were finding it a little more difficult, and on this morning they were cleaning their room and painstakingly making their beds, and our youngest son, Mike, the little fella, and the best way to describe Mike, he's got every stinking attribute I ever had. Cleanliness to Mike is, if you can't see it, it's clean. It was then. He's reached the age now where they take 8 baths a day, though. So on this day, he had kicked everything that he had to under the bed where it couldn't be seen. He stood in the room with his twin brothers, and he watched them working so hard to make these beds. And when they had gotten things where they thought presentable, he couldn't stand such order anymore. He walked in between the beds as he went through the room and pulled the spreads off of both beds. He reached the old cat in a rocking chair and threw her out. His brothers by then had something to say about his actions, and he kicked one of them in the shin and came down the steps, piously singing, "Yes, Jesus loves me." I said to Gay, you know, I don't have any great revelations this morning for you who are a part of this fellowship. I don't know but one kind of AA, and my part of the country, we call it Big Book AA. Now, if you found another way to work this, fine. But you go somewhere else and work it. Don't hang around me with it. I, at my age, don't have time to experiment with new ways. I found a successful way. And my life and my story is not unlike yours. It's a story of darkness. And it's a story that had a period of the first glimmer of light, a faint grayness coming out of the blackness. And then because of you, it is for me this day a story of great light. But the darkest hours of my life came after my introduction to AA. I don't think I need to qualify. Nobody asked me 25 years ago to qualify to be in here. When I walked in my first meeting, they said, welcome. And they had to say it a lot of times over the next 3.5 years. I went to AA my first time not because of any personal desire at all. I went to save my wife, my children, and my job. I loved my wife and then one child as much as an alcoholic is capable of loving anybody. And I had an appreciation for my employment because I had been educated as an engineer. It gave me a sense of belonging and a sense of some achievement, and there had been some in spite of my then alcoholism. I was traveling pretty much over the eastern part of the country for the National Bureau of Insurance Underwriters as a field engineer. And I already had deep troubles. Publicly unrecognized, privately admitted once in a while. Somehow I spent alone in hotel rooms, a bit concerned about me, but not about to discuss it with anybody else. We were living in Chattanooga, Tennessee at the time, and I remember on a Wednesday of the week, and I can remember well days up until that Wednesday, because strangely I had gone through from Monday to Wednesday without drinking. Sometimes you just had to work. And I remembered on a Wednesday afternoon that we were about to celebrate an anniversary at my house, and I called home from over in Nashville, Tennessee, and called Gay in Chattanooga, and I reminded her of the anniversary. Of course, she already remembered, but she was rather elated because I now remembered. And I made her quite happy that day because I called home sober. And I don't know about you. Gay could smell liquor 300 miles over the telephone. And I told her that I would hurry to finish my work and come as early as possible on Friday and to prepare whatever was necessary, and she and our son would go away for the weekend and celebrate in some way, and I hung up the phone, leaving her just very happy. And I sat down in my room a few minutes, and I thought, you know, you have been unnecessarily concerned about your condition. I mean, a man that's in much trouble is not going to be this gracious to his family and his wife. He's not going to be this concerned, and he's not going to remember such days as a marriage anniversary. And I really think, Tom, you're overdoing the concern bit a little. And you probably are really entitled to just a drink to help you hurry and get through this week. And I had it. And I got home on Friday of the following week. And this had then become a pattern. I had my first prolonged blackout. It went 5 days. But I remember awakening again in Nashville, not in the same hotel. And it was as though one comes out of a period of loss, and I was frightened, and then I realized when finding out that I had lost a week, that I had to go home, and I was fearful of what I'd say, of what could happen, of what I might find. And I started home as best I could, and I remember not being too sick. And all the way home, I tried to think of another lie to tell Gay, and I just didn't have any more. They were gone. Now, this might have been the right clue, but it wasn't. And I found this source of arrogance that the alcoholic can dig way down, you know, and get. When everything else is gone, he can get this. And I thought, well, now, here, this is my house. And it's my money. And I have provided well. And I really don't have to take a whole lot of gruff about that. In fact, if it's too bad, I'll just grab a bag of clean clothes and tell I got a call, I got to go. And I came home sort of steeled for the storm that was going to hit. And I opened the door and sort of braced for it. And Gates sat very quietly. And she, in fact, didn't say a word. And I'm going to tell you something. This is terrible when you expect an elder. Finally, she said to me, "Your boss said." "Your boss said." Right away, I know we're in trouble. "When and if you came home, you were not to move from this place till you called him." So I went back to the office that we had in the house, and I thought this woman's ruining me now. She's been talking with him, and they have been talking about me, and he's just going to fire me. And I'm not going to let him fire me. I'll just call up and quit before he can open his mouth. And I dialed his number, and he came on, and before I could say anything to him, he said, "Tom, where in the world have you been?" Said, "Your wife and I have been frantic. We have looked all over the southeast for you. You've been nowhere you're supposed to be. We've checked hospitals, police. What happened to you?" And I had a stroke of genius. I said, "Lee, you know, in all the years I've worked for you, I've never lied to you." I said, "I have been drunk for 5 days. And I left him speechless. And I had this great feeling of power, you know. What a discovery. You hit a guy with the truth and he don't know what to do with it. And he didn't. He fumbled around a bit. He said, I think you've been working too hard." Now he said, "I appreciate you sharing this with me, and I don't want you to say a thing about it in Tennessee, and I'm not going to say anything about it here in New York. We're just going to take this week out of your vacation, and nobody's ever going to know." I thought, what a marvelous thing. And I was ready to say goodbye, and he said, "Just a minute." He said, "Have you ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I had to admit I had. You see, Gay had papered our house with the reprints of the Jack Alexander article. So I said, "Yes, I've heard of this." I even remembered the day I finally read the article, because she desperately, this woman already knew what was destroying her, and anything, and she put them everywhere. It didn't matter where I went in the house, they were there, bathroom, bedroom, kitchen, and I had finally read it in a kind of sense of self-defense, and she waited with rather bated breath while I read. She said, "What do you think of that, Tom?" And I said, that's a sign that we know anybody that needs this. And I said yes to my boss. I'd heard of AA. And he said, "Then your wife and I have been talking about this at times during the past week, and we have decided you need to go." And then he destroyed my power just fine. He said, "If you want to be working for me Monday morning, there is a meeting in Chattanooga tonight, Friday night, and your wife will call the people we have already talked with, and they're going to take you." And I hung up the phone, and Gay said, "Big boy, if you want me here to send you to work Monday morning, you're going to the meeting." And I went to my first AA meeting. Now, we met up over the Singer sewing machine store in downtown Chattanooga. I wouldn't even drive my car downtown that night. They weren't going to see me down in town if you were meeting on Friday night. And I got nothing because I didn't want anything. I thought you were Bible thumpers and drum beaters, and you weren't about to get me on any carination kick, and I wouldn't have anything to do with this. But if it would save my wife, my child, my job, I'd play along. I wanted these. And I went to AA meetings in Chattanooga when I had to. Now, I began stretching the trip to 2 and 3 weeks so I didn't have to go often. I did learn one little thing there, and I'm great for perverting good things. I learned why I was having trouble. Now, this is not a real revelation. I don't know today why I'm an alcoholic, unlike some of my friends who say they know why. I have a friend in upstate New York that said he didn't really know why he drank, and neither did I. He talked about the time he went into college and joined a fraternity, and he said every weekend they all got drunk. And he wasn't very good at it. Before they got started good, he'd either be in the men's room or out back being sick. And one day he stopped the fraternity brother, and he said, "Look, I know this is a splendid thing we're doing every weekend, but why are we doing it?" My present sponsor said he found out why he was an alcoholic. He lives in Luray, Virginia, too. And incidentally, I want you to know that Luray happens to be one, I'm going to say one because I could get argument, of the garden spots of the world. It's in the northern Shenandoah Valley. And at our house, we look out the front windows at the Blue Ridge Mountains, and we look out the back at the Massanutten Mountains. My sponsor lives there in this little place, and he grew up in this little town. This is one of the reasons we're living there today. And he said he found out why he became a drunk very early. He'd lay out on his front porch over in the holler, trying to sober up. And across the ridge, he could hear the railroad trains running on the main line. He said every day they ran 3 trains south and 2 north, and he became a drunk worrying about what they did with the 3rd train. And my sponsor happens to be Julian, who was mentioned here last night. And I'm going to tell you something. You'll miss one of the greatest AAs that God ever put into this program if you don't have him here someday. And he won't appreciate me promoting him. He didn't like to go much. I did learn a thing that sort of solved a lot of problems for me. I learned that I drank because I was sick. And I enjoyed it. I stayed drunk 3 more years being sick. I could come home and stop gay right in the track. I could come in a day or two late, drunk, and she would meet me, and I'd say, "Gay, just a minute." It seems to me I'd say to her, "You're just never going to quite grasp what they've been trying to tell you down at AA." Now, she didn't even belong. I'd say, "Don't you realize that I can't help this? I'm sick." Or the killer, you know. "And don't get me upset." They say that's the worst thing you can do. Some years later, Gay came home from one of her periodic examinations at the doctor, and she was all smiles. She called her then 4 sons and me together and said, "I have some words for you. The doctor said for me to tell you all, for you all never to get me upset again. That's the worst thing you can do." Now, I didn't make it in AA day, of course. But we fooled my employer, and I finally was moved to the city of New Orleans as supervising engineer of that whole area, and was the youngest supervising engineer ever appointed by the National Bureau of Insurance Underwriters. And this in spite of being in the worst stages of my drinking. I moved in on Mardi Gras Eve. On the 4th of July. I was sitting on a bench in a little park called Jackson Square in the midst of Eucharist. My wife and child were gone. My job was gone. I'd even been told not to come back in the office building. And 2 men came in the park on this holiday. They could have gone somewhere else. They could have spent the morning with their family. But I was fortunate. I was only about a block and a half away from the LA Club on Charter Street. And they came in and sat out one on either side. After the moment was just rum dumb enough not to know whether they were police or who. Didn't matter. Because I never loathed a man more than I loathed me that day. So often in clergy workshops and other places, churchmen will say to me, well, if you knew this was going to happen, or could you tell it was going to... Yes, I could tell. I could have almost told you the day it was going to happen. I knew I was going to lose Gay and the son. I knew I was going to lose the job. I knew I was going to lose our home. I knew I was going to lose everything. Oh, God, I didn't know how to stop it. And with two stinking clouds, I asked. And these two fellows said to me, Tom, have you had enough? I knew then who they were. You see, back in Virginia, there was this woman, God's gift to me, who had not stopped praying, who had not stopped calling AAs in New Orleans and saying, please see if he's all right. And up in Chattanooga, there was a little man now dead, and I break no anonymity. Little Bob Irons was one of seven men who stayed sober in the whole city of Chattanooga in my first year around AA. And little Bob was calling AA in New Orleans and bugging him good and saying, come look, I know it's not the way you do it, but just go see if he'll have a cup of coffee with you. And on this holiday, these two men met at the club room for a quick cup of coffee, and before they went their day for the holiday, they said, let's see if we can find Tom. Well, in a little while, I was back in Virginia. Our home was restored. Through the newfound friends of AA, I had a better engineering job than I had been relieved of, in a monetary way. And I had everything going for me except one thing. And this is the dark curtain of refusal. And my life over the next 2.5 years, a little more than 2 years, became the darkest it's ever been. I never had a slip in AA from that day on the park bench in New Orleans. I was drunk 5 times. I don't know anything about slips. I have been very grateful. I don't think I've heard the word here this weekend. I just don't think you can slip off something you ain't got. I went to my newfound friends in Virginia immediately in AA, and I said to them, look, I don't want to drink. It's destroying me. I don't want to be what I've been. And I want to do this program. And they said, fine. But I said, there's a little thing in it that bothers me. Whereupon I was told the biggest lie I've ever been told in my life. Now, I don't think they meant to lie to me. I guess they hadn't grown much either. The guy said to me, look, this is one of those programs, Tom, where you don't take that unless you want it. I mean, what you don't like in this program, throw out the window. You just take what you like. Well, it's a good deal. I went home that night, and I got a set of the 12 steps, and I was sitting on the bed reading them. And step one, no problem. I'm here now. I was admitting to anybody that would listen that I was an alcoholic. Now, accepting it was another thing. Step two, I got into the business about God, and this is the thing I didn't like. They said, throw it out the window. Through the next 11 steps out the window. They're all about God. If you haven't read them, Catholic gurus, but do before you end this day. This is one step about alcoholism. The rest of it's about God and his relationship to Tom Owen. Well, you know what happened? I got drunk. I didn't have nowhere to go back to, like Hal said, except AA. I'm run out of drying out places and quick cures. Back to AA. I got me some new sponsors. I had 5 sets. If they didn't agree with me, I didn't keep them. Well, let's wind it up. The new set were the neo-group therapists. You know, the groups don't do it for you. Just sit down in the group and get immersed in the therapy of this untrained bunch of idiots like me. If they were so smart, they wouldn't be here. And I was therapeutized as few people have been therapeutized. And I might have made it, but my therapist got drunk, and I got drunk with him. Five times. But the small, silent, too often unseen hand of God that is the bulwark of this whole fellowship was quiet at work all five times. At the end of the fifth time, I didn't like me anymore. And I took my first inventory 3 years after AA. And what I found was horrible. I couldn't live with that. But another beautiful thing had been happening for me in AA, too. I had begun to notice people and all around there were folks who were a little different. They had made a great impression, but these little sights and memories that become little precious tidbits that you stick away, and someday God finds a way for you to use them. I came now at this point to the realization that there were AAs, and there were AAs, let's face it. And there was a group within my group who had something kind of special. I've heard my dear friend Walter say the look in their eyes. I've heard Chuck call it the peace of life. I've heard men call it all manner of things. We commonly call it serenity. And you never mistake it. When it's there, it shows. And I've seen this. It might have been in the fellow who was making leads all over the place, trying to help in this way. It might have been in the quiet little guy who comes in early and sets out the ashtrays and stays after everybody's gone and picks them up. Never says a word. You got one in your group. Someday, if you want to shop, find out how many people are sitting in there because of that quiet little guy. It might be in one of the lovely women alcoholics. It might be in a youngster or one of the elders who came early or late. So would I. And there was one in particular. And where I use names, rest assured, these men have already passed from this earthly life and are now enjoying fellowship in the celestial group. There was one named Jack White, who was the first AA in the state of Virginia. Never have I seen such peace in the twinkle of a man's eyes. And I finally called him, and I went to him and sat down with him, and I said, Jack, I've made a horrible mess of this whole thing, and I need help. Would you sponsor me? I'll never forget that saintly old man. He said, I've been watching you, boy, and I was kind of hoping you'd come around someday. And he said, I'll help you. My blackness got some little kink of light. Now, that little bit of light didn't come all brilliant at one time. It chased away a few shadows here and there. It would get very bright for moments, and then it would fade a bit, but this is the way it ought to be for me. I am not equipped to handle the brilliance of a spotlight so quickly out of the darkness from which I came. And the light began to stay longer, though, because I was one who was agnostic. I believed there was a God, but believed I'd forfeited all my rights to God. Now, I didn't like it, and I didn't want to be reminded of it. This dear old man said to me, in sponsorship, I know but one way. Until I think you know as much about this program as I do, you're going to do it my way or get out. We began his way. I recognized right away that this, while saintly, was a profane old man. And he cussed me out. But he began to make me aware that there was a God who cared about me and that I'd just been looking in the wrong places. God had been hidden in a maze of theology and religion for me. I'd come out of a very good church home. I remember the shop a few years ago. Several of you in here who know this mutual friend of ours, Isaac, down in Norfolk, Virginia. Isaac is one of the dearest Jews I know on the face of the earth. And I remember early his first experience in AA. He said he sat around in his early AA meetings and he'd hear one speaker after another get up and say, "I came out of a Christian home." And Isaac said, "I thought about this and I thought, I don't really believe I belong in here. I just was afraid of God, and I had found my fear in not being able to find him in any sense." And I can assure you in honesty today, in the darkest hours of my life, there were times when I looked for God. I just didn't look in the right places. But this dear old sponsor began to open the whole way for me to look. And let me just, and I don't have so much more time, but let me just share with you a few places I've found God in these years since. He comes unexpectedly, but only when a door is open. You don't kick any doors down to get in. You just have to crack it, though. I remember the night that I played myself into the ministry of the church. I'd gone back to church, playing golf with the minister. And I was going through that, why don't others do this and that stage that we AAs go through. I was bugging this man good. Why don't the church do this? Why don't the church do that? The church failed. They never failed us. Do you realize they kept in trust the truths with which we lived for 2,000 years till we got ready to use them? Well, he got tired of me, and he said, "Why don't you come in the ministry and do it?" And for the next week, I couldn't sleep, eat, work. This was the most absurd thing I had ever heard of. I tried to get drunk. Deliberately. 4 days. And couldn't. And a man will tell me there's no God. He's foolish. And I called my minister and I told him the shape I was in. I said, "Come to my house. I got to talk to you." And he came and I told him what was happening. I said, "I'm torn up. You know I don't belong there. I can't do a thing like this." And inside I was thinking, is it possible? And he was very happy. He's happy and I'm dying. He said, "I don't know but one way for you to do this. Now, Tom, you've been giving me this bit about AA and your dependence on God. I mean, don't you think he talked to you about this too?" He said, "I don't know but one way for you to do it. You go off by yourself and whatever way you pray, pray." And I had not yet learned to pray much. And I just went and got on my knees and told him in my own room, "God, I don't know what you're doing to me, but I am willing." And you never saw a brighter sunshine in your life. And I came down and told my wife I had made my decision, and there was never a question in her mind. I went over and saw my minister that day and talked to him. He said, "How are you going to do it?" I said, "Don't know. You have to guide me, but whatever we have to do." And we checked my educational requirements, and I didn't have enough. And I had to go back to college and take courses that had never been prescribed in my engineering degree. And I had to go to seminary. Gay went back to work, and I went up to a little college in Virginia, and I sat in the president's office, and some few weeks had passed, and I told him of my intentions, and I needed his classes, and he said, "How are you going to finance this?" And I said, "I don't have any idea how I'm going to finance this." I said, "In fact, I've still got $5,000 worth of bad checks floating all over the Southeast." Well, I was doing something about them. I'd gone to the domestic relations court in Richmond at the urging of my new sponsor. And I'd placed myself in a voluntary receivership, and every dime I made went to the court to pay off these debts. And this man sat at his desk and he said, you know, I'd already heard you were coming here to talk to me. And this was a surprise. I thought, man, the whole world knows Tom Lovington. He said there were two friends of yours here. And they said if you came here on your own and made application to study for the ministry, that you and your family would have everything you needed as long as you were here. You don't stand any closer to God than that. I said, who are they? He said, I can't tell you. In later years, from my own parish, I was called back to Richmond twice to bury men. And I stood in the presence of the body of my sponsor, Jack, and his sister told me one was Jack. And his family told me of another, Turner, who felt a sense of pride in what God had done with me. You don't ever find God any better than this. I stood in the hospital room one afternoon, and Gay had gone through a painful surgery. And the doctor just come in, and there was great excitement in the room, and they ran out, and I followed him out. I knew something was wrong. She had hemorrhaged horribly for 2 days, and I got them in the hall, and I couldn't catch him, but I got a nurse, and I said, what's wrong in here? And she said, Mrs. Lovin has a blood clot up behind her eyes, and we're afraid it's about to get loose, and if it does, it could kill her. On the hill behind the hospital, almost automatically. And it was drizzling rain, and I stood amidst some pine trees, and I said, God, Gay and I have asked you an awful lot for other people. We've used up most of our requests, but I got one more. I'm going to have to claim your promise. This woman can't stand any more of this. And I went back to her room, and I held her in my hands, and we prayed a little bit together like you taught us to pray. I put her on a stretcher and took her to surgery and brought her back 20 minutes later with her doctor following. And he walked around the room and he'd pick up a book and lay it down and look at her and look at me. And he said, Reverend Lovin, I don't make that kind of mistake. No blood clot. You don't stand any closer to God than this. My oldest son, of whom I have spoken, was the one boy who remembered my drinking. Thank God the twins, no Mike, my youngest, ever saw me. Or the twins were too young to remember. Though I was a part of the ministry, and I know there was a certain amount of pride in the life of this young man, my oldest son, somehow we'd never reached a total communication as father and son, and I desperately wanted that. We had respect for one another, and we had love for one another, and I know he was rather proud of me, his family, but what I wanted wasn't quite there. And I thought too many years had passed, and maybe it was never coming. We were living in Florida at the time, and I took him away to school up in Ohio, and I spent a day or two with him and got up before daylight one morning to start my trip home, and we stood in the darkness of his room, and I am reminded so often how I can stand so many times in darkness and find light. And as I started to tell him goodbye, I wanted to go and put my arms around this boy and maybe kiss his cheek and tell him how sorry I was for that little bit of his life that I ruined, and ask him, please forgive me. I hesitated, maybe a bit embarrassed because he's bigger than me. And as I hesitated, suddenly that big fellow walked across the room and put his arms around me and kissed my cheek and told me how proud he was of me. You won't ever stand any closer to God than this. Just crack the door. Maybe this is egotistical, but it's a part of our family. Our son Mike, who was the youngest, and I guess because I've seen in Mike all the long thoughts that I've had, has become a little bit the apple of my eye. Oh, no more love than for the other boys. At the age of 7 or 8, Mike developed leg crutches disease of the hip, and he was in a wheelchair and on crutches for about 15 months. We were told first that he might never walk again and probably would be crippled the rest of his life. Well, he was not, because all over the world, as Gay and I continued our journey in this way of life, there were hundreds like you who helped us carry our luggage. Mike got well. And over the years, we had him checked and were assured he was well, that there was never going to be any more trouble. And it's one of those things men can't know. About 3 months ago, he was brought in to interview with the Kansas City Royals. He's had a fantastic year as a pitcher in college. And they had offered to sign him now, educate him for the rest of his college education, pay him a salary and expenses, and look after him if he'd sign. And in the midst of all this elation, Mike came home that weekend and he said to his mother, "I need to see a doctor." "We haven't discussed it yet. He'll have to tell us in good time. I strongly suspect that there was a physical somewhere along the line and it was found." We took him over to an orthopedic man and got a diagnosis, and immediately back to the man who tended him as a child and said, yes, there'd been progression of the disease, and within 2 to 10 years he'd have to have an artificial hip. And his career's ended. He's bitter. This 19-year-old worked hard for this. And he and I weren't quite communicating. And I don't know what to say to him. I'm trying to say what you taught me, but he's not hearing good. We called home last night, and Gay talked with him. She said, "How are things?" He said, "Fine." And he was all interested in what you were doing here and how many people were here. And finally, Gay told him about the marvelous programs and everything that was going on. And I tell you, she told him that she ate dinner with Donald O'Connor, too, on Thursday night. She's going to be a little hard to live with for a few days. And she said to her, "Mike, your daddy's going to speak to about 3,000 people Sunday morning. And they've had these marvelous speakers and pilgrims here." Mike said to his mama, "They ain't heard daddy yet." I know God's just bridged the communication gap. I can't wait to get home. We're going to handle this one, too. And finally, this old sponsor said, "Open every avenue." But a man's story in here, I think, has to be the story of his sponsor. And I'm a man who needs a sponsor. When Jack died, I sought another sponsor, and I asked Dutch, who happened to be a Methodist minister and a member of the fellowship of about the same years as my own, if he would sponsor me. And then Dutch was taken away, and I went to Julian and asked him for sponsorship. And each of these sponsors has taught me in a spiritual way some one thing among many that must make me different. My sponsor Jack taught me what I've heard so often said in this place, "I love you." And I didn't know what this meant, nor how to take it, nor how to give it. And it was hard for me to learn. I knew inside I loved, but I didn't know how to tell people. I'd been in the ministry several years. On a Palm Sunday afternoon, a young woman came to our parsonage, and she said to me, "Reverend Lovin, you don't know us, but my husband sent me. Would you please come and see him? He's not been out of his bed 5 days drunk." And I went with her, and we suggested that I follow her in my car, since it was the Palm Sunday and there were special services in my church in the evening hours. And as I drove up the road behind her, I began to get a little resentful at this guy calling me on Palm Sunday. He ought to know how busy I am. I was thinking, if 5 days, he could wait till tomorrow. But I said, "I can hurry now." So I canned my little talk as I went. "I'm going to give him a quick pitch, tell him I'll see him tomorrow if he wants it. Well, we got to his house and upstairs, and she opened the door, and I lost my canned talk. She forgot to tell me he was a hopeless cripple. Sitting against the foot of his bed were these cruel metal contraptions with which he walked. I walked across the room, speechless. And this poor wretch looked at me and said, "Why did you come?" And my sponsor said through Tom Lovern, "Because I love you." A few Sundays later, we got him in a hospital, by the way. He was badly dehydrated, and it was agreed that when he got back, he was a veteran, and they had to carry him away some miles, and we stayed indirectly in touch, and it was agreed as soon as he got home, we were going to spend time together and work this out. And on a Sunday morning, I was already in the pulpit of my church, and we were singing the opening hymn. And to my amazement, this man struggled in the back door with his lovely wife and was helped into a seat. And it was Communion Sunday, and I thought I wish he hadn't come today. I don't get to preach on the day of Holy Communion. There's a lot of things I could tell him from right here. But I bring my own darkness. We finished the ritual of the service and invited people to the altar for Holy Communion, and I saw out of the corner of my eyes he was being helped out of the pew, and I thought he's had too much and they're going to help him out. But again, to my amazement, he was helped down the center aisle all the way. Noisily, painfully. He got to the altar in front and he couldn't kneel, but he propped himself on these things and his lovely wife knelt beside him. I came down the chancel with the communion elements, and when I reached him and reached across the element, the chancel with the elements to Dick, he looked me in the face and he said, "And I love you." I spent last Palm Sunday with him, 14 years sober. He has done more good for paraplegics in the veterans' hospitals than any one single man I know on the face of the earth. My sponsor taught me how to say and feel I love you. And quickly, just another minute, my sponsor, Dutch, I love this man. We were kind of like brothers. Gay and I got caught in a snowstorm over in Eastern Virginia 3 days after Christmas, and we were not too far from his home, and we got into his place and spent 2 days with he and Elsa. And we had a marvelous time in front of the fire, the four of us, enjoying this love. Things cleared out and we left for home, and the next morning they called me and said, "Tom, you'll have to come back. Dutch died last night of a heart attack." And I went back and I met Elsa, and we went up to a mortuary and we sat at the man's desk, and he began to fill out the great list of vital statistics, and he got a few things, and he came to this question, and he looked at Elsa and he said, "Who were his parents?" We couldn't tell him. Because Dutch didn't know who he was. He was an Austrian orphan who stowed away aboard a ship having run away from an orphanage farm. At the age of 13, jumped ship in New York City. And that's the name he bore to his death. And as I sat in that place and left with Elsie, I thought how terribly sad. For a man like this to mean so much to so many thousands of people, and he passes from this life and we don't even know who he is. A couple of days later, I stood by a crypt. We offered to Elsie, and she was very happy about it. She let us bury Dutch in our own family crypt, and there's a place for her. We were about most family he had. And as I stood in the cold winter sunlight that afternoon, conducting his services, the thought occurred to me like great light. It's not important whether or not I knew who Dutch Whitley was. I know what he was. I know what he was. This sponsor taught me that it's more important what you are than who you are. My sponsor today, he's a man of absolute honesty. He will not allow you to discuss AA or anything else in his presence if he thinks there is the first sign of dishonesty involved. And from him, I am learning that I must be honest with Tom Lovin in the face of everything. It makes no difference. It may hurt. It may not be the most popular thing to do. And in that honesty, I have become so aware of my responsibility to this fellowship. I've got four sons. I've got five grandsons and three little granddaughters, and I pray God not a one of my children or grandchildren will ever have to come here. But if they do, I pray every day of my life, oh God, don't let me leave this any less than was offered me. And the only way I know to do it is to be honest with me, with God, and with this program. And it cannot die. I never end the day of my life that I don't stop and thank God for AA. For all of you all over the world, because without you I wouldn't be having any more days of life. I never go in my home and see this angelic woman whose love and whose patience and whose kindness has made my life so rich. And see, they're my children. And now my grandchildren and these lovely girls my sons have brought into the family, that I don't get so that choked up inside, and I just have to stop and thank God for AA and for all of you everywhere, for these are my most precious possessions, and without you I would have lost them. And I never go into the pulpit of my church on the Sabbath morning, and except for about four rare occasions like this, I am there on every Sabbath day at the hour of 11. I stop, and I kneel at the altar, and I pray not to meet any ritual or creed of my denomination, but to spend a personal moment with God and to thank Him for Alcoholics Anonymous and to ask His very special blessing on every one of you wherever you are. For you see, without you, I wouldn't even have this privilege. And I thank God for you today. And I thank Him real good for you. For without you, Gay and I could not have come this way. And now call you friend, too. Thank you.